Bíl buíochas aire as a gcógáil a cheolaic a hifigiú with Maid Hanks Minister for officially opening and launching the conference. And many thanks for your thoughtful opening words there as well. I think your closing reference to Brian Friel reminded me, I think, of what was Jim Larkin's vision of bread on the table and the flower in the vase as one possible vision for a future of society. You touched on the importance of North-South cooperation in that Scotland itself epitomises in its ongoing work. And you announced the forthcoming strategy for teachers' learning, teachers' professional learning, that's going to be published soon, and the emphasis on teachers leading their learning in that strategy. We welcome very much the input and professional advice of teacher educators into the drafting of that strategy, and we welcome that very much. The emphasis on imagination, creativity, and the hunger for knowledge that would feed that vision. And closing towards the end, of that emphasis on a socially just society, but clearly pointing out that teachers and schools cannot achieve that on their own. We must continue to push boundaries together, I think was your closing message at the end. So many thanks for that opening note, Minister. This brings us to our first keynote of Scotland's 2015. And those of us who have heard Professor Kathleen Lynch speak at other conferences or are familiar with her work in any way will know that she continues to live, I think, a deep personal and professional commitment to social justice and equality at the level of theory, but also at the level of practice. She's the Professor of Equality Studies at University College Dublin and holds a senior lectureship in education. She's currently head of the UCD School of Social Justice, and her major area of equality research has been in education, but in the last 10 years she has been working on issues of egalitarian theory and practice with colleagues in equality studies at UCD and indeed beyond. She's authored two significant works in this field, Equality from Theory to Action, and also Effective Equality, Love, Care and Injustice. And the latter was listed as one of Ireland's 100 best books in 2009 by the Irish Times. More recently, in partnership with Bernie Grummel and Dimpinit Devine, she has also published a second edition of their book, New Managerialism Education, Commercialisation, Carelessness and Gender. Tonight, Kathleen will address us on the topic of There Is No View From Nowhere, Ideology, Social Justice and Teacher Education. Can I just give a warm welcome, please, to Professor Kathleen Lynch.
I'd like to thank you very much for inviting me to speak. I'm very close to my homeland of County Clare. but I must say, yesterday when I thought that I had agreed to do this, I began to regret it because it's a long time since I was in teacher education. I suppose I've been educating activists in the School of Social Justice, many of whom are teachers. So I don't propose to tell you how to do your job because I don't know how to do your job. But what I will talk about is, I think, maybe opening up a different view on how we look at issues of social justice and how we look in particular at the importance of the issue of ideology in how we frame questions of justice in education. I hope it's relevant to you, and I'll do my best, I suppose. Is this to the right? Yeah. Here I'm going to talk about five ideologies that I think they matter and that we must involve sometimes their deconstruction. And one is, of course, the principle of equality of opportunity itself, which I think actually is very problematic, not least for the reasons maybe the Minister alluded to, in which I'll talk about in a moment. I will also talk about neoliberalism as the dominant ideology of our time and its implications for new subjectivities that we're creating for children in schools and for young people in further secondary and higher education. And I'll talk about the new organisational forms that have developed from neoliberal brand of capitalism, which we have incorporated into our education institutions, and how we have started to evaluate people through numbers. We actually have what I call the tyranny of numbers, because once a number is stuck to you by your intelligence or your standing or your citation index or your rank or your league table, it is extremely difficult to take it away. And then I'll talk about the problems, maybe more that are endemic to the culture of our society rather than global, the anti-intellectualism, the resistance to new ideas and the impact that that can have if we want to bring about a just society, and particularly my grave concern about justice construed as a problem of charity rather than economic, social and cultural rights, certainly in this part of the island. And finally, I'll talk about the importance of resistance, because I do believe there's resistance. And I think, contrary to a lot of the international media, a representation of Ireland that nobody resisted austerity, I think that is untrue. There have been marches, there have been protests, there has been resistance in education and elsewhere. Its effectiveness is another matter, but I think it's very important. Melucci, one a great professor of sociology in Rome, said the social movements, even if they don't succeed, matter a lot in terms of social justice because they put issues on the agenda, even if they don't succeed. So I'll comment on these in turn. First of all, I suppose this is very... The mind is a site of political struggle. Manuel Castells, great social scientists of Spain, mainland Europe. And I think that's very important. And social power, as I said here through history, but even more so in our type of communication network society, operates through construction of meaning in the human mind through the process of communication. And that's a hugely significant thing for educationists. If we want to bring about a just society, we have to think about how do we engage in the politics of the mind and do we recognize its salience for creating social change. And as quoting Castells here, the smooth functioning of society, the smooth functioning of injustice, which I will show you very recent tables further on in my presentation. I've just written a paper with colleagues and economists on who was affected by the austerity in the Republic, and I'll show you some tables. But we have grown to accept it. We've grown to normalize it. And in fact, we often don't need guns. We don't need armies to keep people in their place if they have learned to know their place. Last night I was at the vigil, and I have to mention it because it saddens me greatly, also I'm godmother to two traveller children, for the children and people who died in Carrick Mines in Dublin. But we have learned to normalise the actual inadequate housing that they have and not to even make it visible. So how do we come to create that society? To have people who actually, we pay €9.60, the budget was yesterday, to children in direct provision. What does it say that we don't even notice them? What does it say about society that we have become so callous that we don't even give them an increase since the year 2000? So those are the questions that I think we need to ask as teacher educators when we talk about equality and social justice. The hard questions. So I'm talking about the power of language and the colonization and regulation of thought through ideologies, through dominant ideologies, and how, in fact, most of the time, we don't even know that we have them. I think one, to me, was brought up in this part of the country and this part of the world, I suppose, was heteronormativity, the assumption that everybody was heterosexual. You never heard anything to the contrary. You couldn't think to the contrary because nobody allowed you to think. Nobody allowed you to think. And I say often, we teach children to read, but we don't teach them to read the world. And that is what I'm talking about here. If we want to create a just society, we have to think about how we can create, as Freire talked about, not just the reflexive teacher, which is very important, but about collective conscientization, collective reflection through dialogue on bringing linguistic mastery and structural understanding of injustice together through dialogue, through talking, through being together, not just through our private recollection. One of those I'd refer to is, what I'm talking here is ideological hegemony, ideas that are so dominant we don't even know that they are part of the way we think about the world. Learning only to see and name the world through the eyes of the dominant. Learning a lot of the time not to know. Or learning fatalism, which I think is very prevalent and has been for the last 5 or 6 years in this part of the country anyway, the landmass that's here, that we can't do anything about it, whereas in fact we can, and it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. So I'm saying here, take something like equality. Most of the time, here, the best we talk about, there are very different intellectual traditions, very different concepts. Mostly we talk about the middle one. Basic equality is basic freedom of movement, freedom of association, freedom from torture, freedom to bodily integrity. Most of the world subscribes to that. But we mostly stop at liberal views of equality of opportunity. And the focus here is on individual rights. And the minister alluded to this importance of equality of opportunity. There is a big problem. Because if you will rely only on equality of opportunity, you have to be able to claim your rights. You have to be a part of a group that has the power to mobilize and the political influence in order to claim your rights vis-à-vis the state. And that is the problem with that kind of thinking that focus only on that. Because, in, as I said here, equality of opportunity, it really means the opportunity to become socially mobile. And I'm not saying that that's not desirable. But as somebody, you know, who came from the west of Ireland and was one of, you know, a family where the tradition of education was strong, but not everybody where had strong ambitions often, but they had no money. So I think, yes, one or two made it. One or two would often make it. So that is what happens. And I think we need to move beyond that notion to the concept of equality of condition, where the focus is making people as equal as possible in all conditions of their lives, especially, I would argue, in economic conditions. Yes, it's true. More equal countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark have greater social mobility than rich countries that are more unequal, especially the United States and Britain. Ireland falls midway between these and indeed is moving much closer to the UK and the United States in terms of the amount of social mobility that there is. Yes, it's true. It does make a difference. Equality of opportunity does. But there are, I would say, five problems. It's about making sure the rules of the game are fair for distributing educational goods on a competitive basis. And it is basically built on the premise that inequality is normative, because you have a ladder. Yes, as I always say, when I'm always amused when people talk about, you know, oh no, we couldn't have the minimum wage, we couldn't have a living wage. It's never, of course, for their own children. It's always for somebody else's child. Somebody else's child can live on the minimum wage, but not my children. And that, I think, is the fundamental contradictions that are there, that we must start to say, okay, if you have a hierarchy, you may bring in migrant labour, you may bring in refugees, but somebody is going to do the low-paid, dirty, menial, and disregarded work if you have work and people treated that way in any society. But I'm saying we have to think about eliminating major hierarchies of power, wealth, privilege. They're very contentious. People will not give them up without a fight. I think there are a lot of people who are very innocent about, oh, if we teach people who are rich about inequality, they'll feel very guilty and they'll give everything up. I would say that the empirical evidence, unfortunately, historically, is not on the side of that argument. I think also inequality are based on a meritocratic myth. I did have several studies on inequality, but one with a young PhD student at the moment of mine who is from, lives in public housing, has two young children, and a young woman, main earner, part-time job, everything. And she said something that's very telling, I think, about class inequality. She said, there are two classes of people, she said, when it comes to equality of opportunity. The people who are on the life raft and the people who are in the yachts when there's a storm, who do you think will get home to shore? And what I'm saying here, if we ignore inequalities, massive income inequalities, I was absolutely astounded the other day to read that somebody said that the chief executive of a company should be, really, we should have 150-to-1 ratio. 150-to-1 ratio, as would be a legitimate ratio. What a ridiculous suggestion. You cannot have equal participation in education. Even if you have 20,000 or 25,000 euro and somebody else has 50,000 or 60,000, what will happen, of course, is what has already happened, is people will use their private resources to actually advantage their own children economically through buying grinds or tutorials or sending them to more socially selective schools or whatever. So if we have economic inequality, we will have educational inequality. And the other thing that we have is, even if you take groups like people with disabilities, and I don't like the word disability, by the way, I hate that negative prefix of dis because it implies there's something absent. I actually think the word should be diffability, differences in ability. But let's say you take somebody like that. Of course, even if you look at the disability movements or even the LGBT movements, the people who can come out are those who are from the more privileged classes because resources to protect them can move social networks, can move places. The same in terms of advancing with disabilities. It's even we saw lately from our own data here, for example, that the people who get most likely to get assessments, for example, reasonable accommodation, they're disproportionately in more middle-class schools because they can pay 500 euro to get a psychological assessment. So what I'm saying here is we advantage the relatively advantaged among the disadvantaged in that system. That's not a bad thing to do. But we leave the majority of people where they are. And the other thing is, with this meritocratic myth, IQ, which I never believed in, and wrote an article 35 years ago, and I was so pleased to see how Gardner's work in Harvard and many other people absolutely, you know, blow that myth apart that people are born naturally with intelligence, etc. But that myth is out there, that there's some intelligent, some not, and if you work hard, you're going to make it. But that is not true. Because actually, if you have more resources and more privileges, especially economic privileges, you will buy that advantage in the labour market. You will buy it like they've done in the United States by setting up, for example, all these very elite liberal arts colleges. And then you can go on and do your graduate programme somewhere else. You buy it here through attending from more socially selective schools or grind schools or whatever. So I think that, it blames the victim. So I think there is a big problem with that. And also, when we focus on inequality of opportunity, we always focus on the subordinate. We don't problematize how it is that people maintain their privilege. Because I don't think doing better educationally, doing better in examinations, certainly, is very dependent on money. And equal opportunities policies don't give enough attention, nor do we examine how the privileged maintain their privilege, how they have resources and et cetera at their disposal, which will advantage their children, or they can repeat the exam, or they can. There's a young woman who lives not far from me in Dublin. She's been 9 years in UCD, her father, I met her lately. She's eventually qualified as a vet. But she had dyslexia. She got all the supports that were there. She went and came, you know, went to an extra school year. She did an undergraduate degree in science. She'd repeated several years. She eventually was able, through having plenty of money, to follow her dream. But most people in an economically unequal society are not in that position. So I'm saying we need to look at the structural causes of injustice, the legitimation of the fact. I mean, I was very strongly influenced. I'd been in Mondragon, and if you may know, the cooperative region in the Basque Country, where this whole principle of 89,000 people employed in a 5-to-1 ratio, maximum to minimum income. I do think we have to start talking about that if we're talking in teacher education about a just society. The politics of having enough. When have we got enough? What is enough? And what do you need to lead a good life? We even know from research by economists now, in terms of happiness and even human well-being, that beyond a certain level of income, I don't know what it does, it varies by society, it actually doesn't make people any better off in health or welfare or sense of well-being to have lots and lots of money. I'm not saying people don't like it for power or other reasons, but we know that it isn't actually as beneficial as it may appear. So I'm just saying, too, that when we have all this ideology out there of if you work hard and you're intelligent, you're going to make it, of course the children who don't succeed are going to feel like they're failures. They feel that they are not of worth. And I think that's an absolute disaster, that even at the Leaving Cert here, you'll have somebody who has been told they should get into X, Y, and Z course and they get 480 points. And they come out and they feel they're a failure because they didn't get into something. And that, I think, is a very destructive system, destructive of young people's dreams and their ambitions, that we don't actually look at how problematic that is. So the other ideology I'll refer to is, of course, quite separate, really, and unrelated, but it plays on the latter. And this is the dominant political ideology in the Western world, and that human beings can be advanced by liberating individual entrepreneurial freedoms within an institutional framework characterized by strong private property, free markets, and free trade. And state intervention, especially unless it is protecting market interests, is to be kept at the minimum. We see that here now. There is a gradual withdrawal of the state, an attempt to privatize an awful lot of services, including in further education, including in the health sector, most obviously, and in my view, and I will say it, although it's an education conference, scandalously with the care of the elderly, and handing it over to for-profits. And I'm very interested, the minister referred to children who are, we would say, children in care here. I think most people, I'm supervising another study in that area, most people here may not realise that most children in residential care now in the Republic of Ireland are in places run by for-profit companies. And that is the way we have gone, and we haven't gone there accidentally. We have gone there deliberately because the looked-after child, as the minister called, has not mattered enough to put proper institutional care in place to protect them. So what I'm saying here is, I think that this neoliberal values impacts on the culture of education. The market becomes a primary producer of cultural logic and value, And it informs how we think. We think always about money. What does it cost? Is there money to be made? And I'm a realist about money. I'm always, it's a joke in UCD, I'm always looking for money. I'm always out tendering for money. I'm well aware of economic reality and that you have to fund yourself on that. I'm not saying we haven't to be realistic. But the language of citizenship in education has been replaced by a language of choice and efficiency and a focus on customers. So the schools are adopting business models of operation and institutionalizing commercial values by default, if not by design. And what I'm saying here is new managerialism is the organizational arm of neoliberalism. It is what has been introduced, which is a move to actually institute into the public sector, into education, models of operation that are taken from business. And I think that's very problematic because, as I said here, public services like education mutate from being centres for welfare, good education, health educator, based on human need and governed by human rights, to service delivery operations with productivity targets. And I fear that if we start to count everything, and if I'm not saying we shouldn't be accountable, but we have to find ways of being publicly accountable without always counting. And I think it is, the problem is that new managerial is product focused. So if you take the business model, the outcome is always the thing that matter is profit, the share price, you know, the price of equities, the price of bonds. That's always what matters in that, that's that world. But if you introduce those values into public education, tables, key performance indicators, I think you lead to a real equality and social justice problem because efficiency disincentivizes you from assisting needy people. Why would you take students who are going to lower your league table standing? Why would you take like I've heard this debate many times in UCD, the cost of having students with disabilities. They take so much time, etc. But that is a mentality that develops when no resources follow and when people don't realise that if we're too inclusive, it does cost resources. And as I make the point here, for example, US law schools, and this, there was a proposal that it was be done in Irish universities, actually, some years ago, that your ranking would be lower if you took in students with lower points. And of course, we know the students with lower points are more likely to come from more disadvantaged backgrounds. So I'm saying there's a strong disincentive in this product-focused system to actually not do social justice in education because of the danger of this public image that it might bring. And so that your ethical disposition, which is, and education is fundamentally an ethical practice, is subordinated to pragmatism, to the next round of where you stand. And I fear that in this part of the island, we're moving in the same direction as mainland UK in terms of moving towards this kind of league tabling. And it is, of course, parents and powerful middle-class parents, I have seen it many times in schools, in research and elsewhere, want, of course, to maintain their class privilege. But it has to be spoken back to them that that is what they're doing. They are not, and most parents are highly particularistic, they're not interested in other people's children. So I'm fear that in that, if we follow that route, market accountability replaces democratic responsibility. And it also has moral implications. Because what happens, I think, when we introduce into institutions a market principle, it overrides and weakens other values. Second order, they become first order principles like care for children. And I fundamentally, I've written a lot about care and that would be another lecture, another time, another day. But like you can't learn unless you're loved, as Freire said. You cannot learn. And I don't mean sentimental love. I mean where people actually are really interested in you. But those values, the care for children, the making sure that the ones whose, all the difficulties that they pose to us are looked after, trust, integrity, solidarity, are subordinated to control, competition, and regulation if we are only about counting our productivity. So I also think that it changes the culture of how we relate to one another and how we see young children. Because it creates a new cognitive space where people are judged whether they're these terrible things. They'll say, is it an A student or a B student? Is it a D student? How could a human being be reduced to an indicator? Not least of which the simplicity of that is often based as Gardner and others have spoken about on linguistic and mathematical intellectual capabilities alone. So I think there's a reification of identities, and this and include ubiquitous citation of numbers, where the number follows you because you've been labelled as this class of person or this type of disability. And there is also almost like a prison sentence that you have no way of getting rid of it. So I'm very sceptical of that, of what I call the tyranny of numbers, because they present a semblance of objectivity, a myth that what can be hierarchically ordered can be incontrovertibly judged. And I don't think that's true. We can order a lot of things, but we may not know the value of those things. And I think, therefore, what happens with these numbers is they become self-fulfilling prophecies for schools, for individuals, indeed in the university, in the ranking systems, and in the citation systems. And also, I think it changes the culture of our teaching and how we teach one another. If we're always in competition for the grades, the best students, the best, you know, league table or whatever, well, fabrication becomes a virtue in itself. I've just yesterday spent 2 days analysing CVs for some research posts, and I often am amused, and sometimes amused in not such a funny way, by the extent to which we have a fabrication of the self has begun to grow into CVs now, where the minor achievement is lauded as if it had altered the course of history. But you can't blame people for doing it, because that's what they're actually rewarded for. And I think it will change in higher education. We've seen it, for example, it's very well documented now, the rise of academic capitalism, where individuals' careers become their project. You reward people for being successful, they have high citations, publications, and they become stars. I absolutely hate that language. They become stars, and therefore there's involved in gaming. So you can cite people and get other people to cite you, and all of this becomes an industry, and not knowledge, not real education, but actually the promotion of the self. And I suppose I fear that I've said that enough there, I think about it, but I fear that truth expressed in numbers, when you rank a child, when you give them a label, when you put them in a position, I think it is a truth value and status that is less contestable than truth expressed in narrative form. And I think you can only be altered by more numbers and more ranking and more league tables. And they become normal and naturalised through familiarity and ubiquitous citation. And there's nothing that sticks to your identity without being labelled as a stream C or a B child. You can remember that in a way that you mightn't remember the long-winded commentary that your teacher made where they were trying to say that maybe you could do a little bit more work. So what I'm saying here is we are creating, I think, and maybe this is a subject for teacher educators, with new managerialism at the organisation level, neoliberalism at the more political and cultural level, that the citizen's relationship to the state is being mediated by the market, through the market. That we are defining citizens as customers, and it is on the Department of Education and Skills website. There is a customer section. New consumption-led subjectivities are created both inside and outside in education. So you must consume the service, but education is a human right, protected by the International Covenant Economic and Social Cultural Rights, by the Universal Declaration. It is not a shop product that you may or may not take off the shelf. You require it. So why are we using the language of the market about human rights? And I think what's happened, therefore, that education is seen as a product that you can buy and you can manage your risk. The development of what I call the actuarial self. So everybody and every parent looks on education as something they consume and that they can protect their children. I'm not blaming people for doing this. I'm talking about a cultural practice that has developed that we need to contest. And it symbolized this possessive eye in the use of Apple's use of the iPhone and the iPad, because, of course, it's a marketing strategy. It's the performing eye of the CV. So everything is about what you can measure and your performance. I do think we have to name it, because by naming it, I think we can contest it. Now, to be more local, if I may, how did they take hold? People often say that. Oh, yes, they took hold in other countries, and I think it's true. But I think neoliberalism took hold here. There's Collins is a professor of business in Cork and UCC, I think. I can't remember if he's a professor or not. He's written a very good book on how new managerialism, that was incorporated into the Irish civil service. But I think what happened was there's a very strong anti-intellectualism in Irish academia, including the social sciences and education. And indeed, in Irish political life, I have been a few times, not that often lately, because for various other reasons, on the media. And the first thing they'll say to you is, oh, don't use those words. Don't use those terms. You mustn't use anything like that. Why do they not want people, if the terms become familiar, people will start to use them. They will start to talk about neoliberalism. They will start to talk about new managerialism. These are not mysteries. But there is that resistance to doing it. And the other thing, we have a long history of resisting it. Marxism, feminism, communism, humanism, socialism have all been demonized historically in this part of the island. And like I was involved, I don't know if anyone here, in long 30 years ago, in trying to introduce critical social scientific subjects to second level education. But it was strongly resisted by at all levels, including, sadly to say, at the time, by teacher unions who feared that their subjects, namely home economics and at the time, and history, feared that if sociology was introduced, for example, as a mainstream subject, that those subjects would lose out. Maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong. In fact, we brought people at the time from Northern Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. We ran a major campaign with political scientists. Nothing ever happened. We have not even got those subjects as proper subjects in the second level syllabus. And I think that says a lot about Ireland's attitude to social justice. We actually don't have and enable students to have the intellectual tools to analyse society, to name the world, and to know the world in the language of science of that area. And what I'm saying is, in this part of the island, the post-colonial elite consolidated their position. It's a whole debate about post-colonialism. Please don't attack me on that. But what I'm saying is, there was a consolidation after the Republic was formed, politically and ideologically. And I would argue I've just written a paper showing that equality and social justice were really of rhetorical value. They were things that people appealed to, they were rhetoric, but only when the EU, for example, forced us to actually adhere to equality legislation in the 1970s, etc., did we do so. We didn't do it voluntarily, and we tried to seek derogations right to the last minute. So I think there is a big problem in our attitude to it. There is a laissez-faire. The chattering classes, of whom I'm one, belong to the middle class. And I would say that about the academy. We have become too privileged. We are too privileged. We are too divorced from a lot of us. I'm not speaking of everybody here by any manner of means. But I think a lot of us became part of the elite, the intellectual elite, who serviced the economic and political elite. And I also think that underneath it all, deep, deep down, the definition of justice in this part of the island, I can't speak as well for the north because I haven't studied it, is that of charity. If you take Christian tradition, which is the dominant tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, very simple message, love one another as I have loved you. It's not really hard to understand. Yet, we remain in both parts of the island, and I can speak with data now in the south, among the most economically unequal countries in Europe. And I would argue our view of social justice is actually one of charity. We will give out of our beneficence when we have something left over, but don't oblige us to do it. And then we will claim that we are morally superior by doing so. Instead of being requiring ourselves to meet our obligations as citizens, we see ourselves as customers who are not obliged to do that because customers only shop around and maybe they don't like that and maybe they don't want to fund it. One charity might be better than another. And I take a quote here that people have begun to believe their own rhetoric. And last year, Minister Michael Noonan, he was not the only one, other ministers said it, I'm not party political at this at all, I'm not a member of any party. It's impossible to deliver tax relief to people who don't pay tax. Well, I'd just like to show you this table. I don't think most of you have seen it. It's forthcoming in a book that we have, and it's from by the Nevin Research Institute. This is at the present time. The poorest 10% in this part of the island pay over 30% of their net income, which is mostly social welfare, actually, or welfare dependent, in tax. The richest 10% pay just over 29%. They pay it through income tax, through the earned, what they get through earnings. The others pay it through indirect taxes. And the reason I put this picture out there is because there is a myth, and this is ideology. This is a fine example of it, that poor people and people on social welfare pay no tax. We have one of the most regressive systems of indirect taxation in Europe. Really regressive. You know, most people don't realise they pay VAT on a chocolate bar, they pay VAT every time they pay their ESB, they pay VAT when they buy petrol, they pay VAT, etc. And all the other indirect taxes that are there. So I'm just saying, why do we accept that? And how did the ideology get out there that poor people pay no tax? And let us look at child poverty. We looked at it from 2008 to 2013. There is another myth that we cherish all the children equally, do we? Well, this is from the CSO, the Central Statistics Office data. And you can see deprivation rates have risen exponentially. And that means being deprived of two basic things, such as heating and of food, good clothes, etc., at a given time. Yes, the at-risk of poverty rate for children has dropped slightly, but the actual consistent poverty rate stands at 11.7% at the moment for children. That is children living in consistent poverty. It is almost 50% above the adult rate. So if we're really concerned about equality in education, then we must be concerned about this, because children do go to school hungry in this part of the island. That is a fact. Anybody who's working in one of the more socially disadvantaged areas know that. So I suppose I'm questioning, how is it we don't see this? And how is it that we don't hear it? And why do we not act on it? And my argument is that we have a careless state before and after the Celtic Tiger era. We've had social class segregated schooling, which has been upheld, I might add, by teaching professionals and faith-based groups. We still have elite socially selective fee-paying schools. We have schools that actually select in ways that make sure that they don't have travellers and others. We have, of course, that happens in many ways, but I'm only saying we have not had a major attempt to change that, despite numerous debates and numerous protests. We've also had a long history of segregation by religion, by gender, travellers, disabilities, etc. And I think all that has changed in 10-20 years is that now what's happening with neoliberalism, which you create a culture of fear. Because neoliberalism is based in creating a view that everybody must look after themselves. And if you break up solidarity, if you break up concern for a public state, for a welfare state, that we such as little as we have of it here, then of course everybody's going to look after themselves. Look at the rise in the gated households, the rise in gated communities, the movement of a lot of people into Gaelscoileanna in South Dublin. I can assure you it is not for their love of Irish. It is often for their love of the fact that they know there would not be immigrant children in those schools. So I'm just saying that we have a lot of movement of people becoming self-protecting. And you have the rise of the for-profit sector. You have Hibernia, you have DBS, and we've built it on a tradition of exclusive schooling. And I'm not saying that Northern Ireland is that different. I believe there are many issues in relation to how education is working out there in terms of the old grammar schools and their resistance to the ending of the 11 plus, etc. Let's not delude ourselves if we are going to pretend that we're concerned about equality and at the same time we're doing our best to maintain our elite systems. So what I'm saying is there is no view from nowhere, and I clearly have a view. I do believe in equality and social justice, and not just in theory, but in practice. We've tried to implement it where I work and teach people to do it in practice, not just in theory. But I suppose the questions I would say is, in all education, one of the things I do, I teach a course on inequality in Irish society in UCD, I'll leave this year, but not teaching it, to undergraduates. And one of the first things I do is I get them, if they have them, because nobody has books anymore, they're all online. But if they are online, I get them to look at their journals, academic journals, and see where they're published. And if they have a book, I get them to look at the book. And I get them to look at the names. And I get them to look at where they're produced. And in all, you will see the power of poor capitalist states, the power of the metropole. You will see the power of London and New York in the publishing industry. And you will see, of course, that the view of the world often that you get is the view of Eurocentric view, often a white view, and a view often of very powerful men, disproportionately to women. So I say, how did you come to know what you know? And how and who shaped what we know? Who are we and how does it affect our knowing? Because that's a very fundamental question for teacher education. The positionality of the theorist. I would say, people often say to me, like, will you represent so-and-so? And I said, no, I won't represent travellers. I'm not a traveller. What we have to do is, like, we started a course in UCD, Travellers' Rights and Justice course last year, level 3 and level 4, which is taught by travellers. It is taught by travellers. Every single module is taught by travellers. We will not have people go and colonise their lives anymore and talk about them and claim to know their world better than they know themselves. So to me, emancipation in education is about enabling everybody, whether it's people who are blind or deaf or whatever, to come to know and claim their own world, to be in power and position of naming that world, and for us to know where we've come from in our colour, in our ethnicity, in our beliefs, and of course, I admit that, of course, we could be wrong, but at least we know that we have only one viewpoint in the world. And I suppose that's the last question I have. How do we bring this view into teacher education? I'm not an expert in that, but I do feel if we believe it, we will find a way of doing it. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Míle buíochas, many thanks, Kathleen, for a most thought-provoking keynote to open our conference. You opened by talking about the tyranny of numbers and the mind as a site of political struggle, and you put some very challenging questions to all of us throughout, but at the beginning talk, ask us to reflect on what kind of society do we have, how aware are we of that society, how well do we understand it, and if you get to that stage of reflection and insight, what kind of society do we all want? You talked about teaching children to read, but not to read the world as one of the problems to be overcome. And it reminded me of my history methodology lecture in UCD when I was in the HDIP, who has quoted the history teacher, who was a student of theirs previously, who said they teach their students to trust nothing that they read. And you're talking about challenging the mindset that we can't do anything about the challenges and the difficulties in achieving equality, and remind us that we can. Remind us, I think, of the power of our own agency and of our own collaborative agency, perhaps. You talk about the equality of opportunity, perhaps being another seductive narrative, how it tends to favour those who are best placed to claim their rights, and I suppose rest in that sense of positional power as opposed to equality of condition. What is enough, you asked us? What is a good life? And talk about the language of citizenship, that we need to be publicly accountable, I think you said, without always counting. You cannot learn unless you are loved, I think, evoking the idea of human connections being at the heart of teaching and learning. And I think at the very end, I think the idea of teaching and learning being about that sense of empowering or enabling everybody to come to know and own their own world. I think that's a lovely note to close on. So we've got a bit of time now, actually, for questions, answers, comments, or observations. We have